Lives. I don't know what happened, but here we are. Look, good morning. My name is Dean. I work on the Internet Explorer team. We are really happy because a week ago today, we went live with Internet Explorer 8 for a variety of flavors of Windows and about 25 languages. And I saw that not a lot of people watched the mixing. And that's okay. The mixing is available on demand. Frankly, I recommend you watch it. If for no other reason than the opening video was one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. Right? They did a great job on remembering the Internet. Then the next 23 minutes aren't that bad either. The next 23 minutes are another lap around IE8 from a slightly different point of view. What I wanted to do this morning, given the folks who are here, is give you a little bit more of the behind the scenes. So I want to offer you some of the what we were thinking when we designed it and how we came to the design of IE8, along with some healthy perspective on what I'll call the developer and IT pro opportunities. And the slide that you see is something that is this talk that we've done on and off for a while called Ordering Pizza for 100 Million People. It's really order of magnitude 10 to 8. There are several hundred million people. I'll just call it about 100 million people. Because in some ways, when there's a piece of software that this many people use, in this many different ways, you really are, to use an Americanism, trying to order pizza for this amazingly large and disparate group. And I want to describe a little bit about what went into that. I will hope that all of my appropriate events get sent through to PowerPoint. There we go. All right, so the basic agenda is you know, how to develop software at this scale, because I think we're all kind of developers and IT pros, and you know, frankly, intellectually, that's a fascinating concept. How do you develop software for a few hundred million people? There are popping sounds. There are some fun motivations, like why change it, the thinking that I told you, and then the product itself. And I've got a couple of assertions. Interactive is always a good thing. And so I'm used to being cut off. I'm from the East Coast of the United States. I expect someone here will very soon raise their hand or shout out a question. If you are jacking over the net, I'm sure that Nathun will represent you fairly and interrupt me. And so questions are fun, and I encourage them. All right, so first, the question, why change IE? This is one that I've sat down, frankly, for very long, long sessions about with industry analysts and with pundits. Boy, there's a period of time when changing the browser seemed like a very bad thing. And, you know, if you talk to certain people today, changing the browser is still a bad thing. The people who are responsible for millions of desktops across a dozen or so time zones, right, and keeping line of business applications running, really want just calm peace. They want nothing to change because it's challenging enough to keep all the systems running as it is. So there's going to be a spectrum of answers around changing the browser. There are some people who want a nightly build of the browser and want to know what's the latest that happened, what's the latest dash CSS vendor name tag that got implemented. And then there are people who are running nuclear submarines on a browser. I'm not kidding. Right? All right, I'll just keep the nuclear thing going. My brother, bless him, is a nuclear cardiologist. He looks at images of hearts that have been, you know, sourced through radioactive blah, 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 blah. And all I know is he's sitting there in the browser looking at pictures of hearts making diagnostic decisions. And so one could argue that from a security and reliability point of view, you really don't want anything thermonuclear to change, you know, with a nightly build. And then, you know, there's this healthy spectrum of things. So let's talk about the motivation. Well, let me start with the most easy motivation, the rise of the malicious web. Now, this is one that people make a living off of. They're not always necessarily savory people, but they do make a living off of it. And the rise of the malicious web is absolutely amazing. If I told you in 2002 that you could be driving to work or sitting in an airport or, you know, just looking at headlines scroll by on a CNN ticker, and there'd be things around SQL Server injections, you know, bringing business to its knees, you probably would have laughed. And it turns out that the malicious web is for real. And the set of people who are getting attacked and how they're getting attacked just never stops anything. And it's very straightforward. There's money involved, and there are people connected to the web. And so there are attacks on a daily basis. And real people get attacked in real ways, and there's a responsibility that browser vendors have to keep people safe. There are user expectations in the ubiquitous web. Back when giants walked the earth in the mid to late 90s, you know, there are all these jokes around, oh yeah, you know, somewhere at MIT there's a soda vending machine that's got an IP address and people can see if there's enough soda in it. And everyone laughs because it seems completely ridiculous. And now, you know, it's not that ridiculous. People go through and have their webcams hooked up to their office to see what's going on when they're not around, and it seems like everything's got an IP address. There are implantable medical devices that have IP addresses so they can be remotely managed in nice ways. That's a, you know, C.1 malicious web, right? Like there's this whole notion. You kind of don't want to walk into a Starbucks and have somebody there with Wi-Fi on reprogram an implantable medical device in your body. Bad, bad scenario. But user expectations keep going up. User expectations go up because they expect things to get easier, they expect things to get faster, they expect to work less hard and have more benefit come to them. And that's just one of those fundamental human rights when it comes to using computers. That's just what people expect. Developer expectations are huge, and in some ways that's really why we're here today. Developer and IT pro expectations around not just the web, but the richness of the web and the interoperability of the web. And that drove a lot in the design of Internet Explorer 8. Now the next part is, how do you challenge all the assumptions? Because for all these areas, there are all these things that people go, well, it could never be that, or I don't know how to do that. It's what we'll call the tyrannies of or, right? I want it to be a lot faster, but I also want it to be more robust. It needs to crash less. Those don't always go together. I need it to be more interoperable, right? I need the code that I write for this browser to work in these other browsers, interoperable. But I also want it to be just as compatible. The code that I wrote to work in this browser yesterday needs to keep running in this browser today. Those are kind of exclusive, if you think about it. Like I told this browser, when I say go left, it really means go about 30 degrees. And these other browsers expect go left means about 42 degrees. And I can't be 30 and 42 at the same time. So how do you do that? And there are a broad spectrum of assumptions that you can see here. You know, what do safety and trust mean to real people? It's one thing to sit in a room of security experts and have them argue about the angels on the head of a pin in a particular kind of attack. And it's another thing to, you know, watch someone I'm related to make a trust decision. Like, is this really the site that they meant to go to? Right? Is it phishing? Is it malware? You know, when my brother downloads his emoticon screen, his emoticons bar, does he understand what software he's just put on his machine and what awful things come with it? There's a session later today that even if you think you don't care about security, you've got to go see the session. It's amazing. And maybe the big one that I want to point out is how the browser works across services. We keep hearing about web applications. Yay, web applications. They're great. People are writing them, right? You can think of a lot of different web applications. But today in our daily life, you don't just use this web application or that web application. You use a sequence of websites, and some of them are applications-y, and some of them are more website-y. But what we end up doing is stitching them together. And I'll show you some examples of this. And the data that we have and how we saw people using the web, it wasn't around just sitting in this web app or sitting in that web app. It's how people use the entire web together, no longer just one side at a time. Now, I'll show you some examples of this. Yes. So just to repeat the question for the folks who aren't in the room, there's a question on mashups. I'm going to talk a little bit about mashups from a developer enabling point of view, and then mashups from an end user point of view. The conversation on mashups started, say, around 2005, if I get the year right. I think it's around 2005. And what's interesting is that in that time, we've all been on the receiving end of a mashup here and a mashup there. Right? Invariably, there's some data and there's some map. And you go, yay, there's a mashup. Then the question is, who's created their own mashups and gotten their own value out of mashups? And it's a very, very small number. And, you know, frankly, I think I owe you, because you really speak to this last point, which is, how do people really use the browser? Because there are 100 million people who aren't do-it-yourselfers, to whatever degree we in this room are do-it-ourselvesers. All right. The key thing here is that we end up using data to help customers a lot. And we really were amazingly data-driven. And when you ask the question, how do you operate for 100 million people plus, you then ask, how to use data? And I'm going to roll a video. Are you prepared? Okay. I'm just going to show this video and let it speak for itself. Is that loud enough? Should I pause? All right, for the audience at home, we're going to pause. Oh, I love it. The escape key actually did the right thing. You never know when that's going to happen. I'm going to raise the volume. That is going. That was going. I think you're plugged into the microphone, Jack.
Ah, sorry. Really? I'll take your word for that. See how that goes.
You think? That could be true. Okay. So data enabled us to make the decisions and designs that we needed to make for, again, order of magnitude 10 to the 8th. And I think that there's an important exercise which is around understanding what you do with the data. So, boy, there's a lot of data. Now, this is what I'll call one of the more interactive parts. For the folks who are here, I'm going to ask what you see here. I'll offer a couple of things that I've heard as I've shown this to other groups of developers and IT pros and computer science PhD candidates. I've heard suggested old woman wearing a scarf, distressed concrete, a couple of descriptions of cloud patterns. Do folks see anything else in particular here? I'm sorry, go ahead.
My dad's a doctor and a radio, so I see feet.
You see feet and a radio, yes? You see a calf, okay, in the back. Mountain with snow, okay. I saw another hand up, sir. Great Orion Nebula, okay. Again, look, this is just a visualization of data for a moment, right? This is just data, right? So it's great because basically you look at data, and initially when you look at, you know, when you do any pivot out of the SQL database that's got crash data, you do any pivot out of, you know, or pull out of the database that says, okay, well, what toolbar buttons are people using and how might they be using them? It looks, frankly, a lot like this. Are there any other suggestions? Just ideas, things that people thought they saw? There's a problem inside of it. No matter what this is, this is a developer. This is the heart and mind beat of a developer. Right? It's like, I know that there's a picture, but there will be a problem. All right. So now we'll draw a line. And, you know, someone, you know, just in relative terms, saw a calf. And, you know, there is this line there. And you can kind of see that there is, okay, well, there's a cow of some kind. And now that you've drawn this, you can kind of see that there was this cow there. Now when you look at this, it's obvious. Like, how do you not see this cow? And in some ways, that's, you know, part of the magic of software design at the scale. It's very easy to sit around and do what I think was classically called, you know, caffeine-driven development, or maybe argumentative development, that you have three people in a room, and they'll yell at each other, and they'll say, we should or shouldn't have a toolbar button for this feature. This feature is cool. We should have a toolbar button for it. No one will use this feature. Well, three really important people will use this feature, and they'll go around and around in circles. But, you know, with instrumentation and with a lot of data, you can do some amazing things. And, you know, boy, we have some really interesting detailed data come out of this. But again, this data is more of just, you know, it's that cloud. It's the, you know, you don't know if there's a cow. Like, I could put up this other image, and people will definitively say, oh, well, that one's got a sheep. And you kind of go, well, maybe, maybe not. And so there are some great examples of some of the questions that we were looking at, like, well, what are the commands people use the most, and how do they categorize, and what does that mean, and what are the common sequences? Then you go through and you say, well, what pieces of raw data that we have? People using the favorites bar get to where they want to go faster than the people who don't use the favorites bar. And we can quantify that in some very interesting ways since we have instrumentation. But what do you go do with that? And so let me show you this artist's mock-up of Internet Explorer 11.5. The best part about this is we didn't actually have to draw it. Someone out in the industry drew this. And you can kind of date when this came out based on some of the names that are on here. Like, you know, I hadn't seen Dogpile in a couple of years. That used to be very hip at some point. And there are all these other things. And what you'll see is that there's about this much room, say, you know, 50, 60 pixels, right, for your web page. And, boy, there's all this other stuff. So you can get a lot of data and then overreact in all sorts of non-helpful ways, right, and just create command surface after command surface, including but not limited to this purple gorilla that's, you know, juggling coconuts. And so, again, I'm going back to saying, look, there's all this data, there's understanding user intent, and then there's how creatively you find the cows in the cloud of data. So what did we actually do? Well, we took the data and we took the people who we had and we tried to get an understanding of each of the customer groups, right? And I know it sounds cliche, but we went through and we had people who really lived as developers, as web developers, and said, okay, what's the pain that you go through? What's the pain that you think the community goes through? What's the data behind your understanding of this pain? Same thing for end users. And, you know, there's a broad spectrum of end users. You know, everyone in this room is an end user of the browser in some way because we browse. But then you have, you know, the uninitiated. You have students. You have medical professionals. You have all these different groups, financial professionals. I think there's still a few of those left, right? And so, anyone, okay, I know there was bad AV before, but we can still have fun, right? Okay. And we built a sequence of prototypes. Now, the sequence of prototypes has rarely, if ever, been seen outside of Microsoft hallways, because this is really, you know, our sketch. This is literally an artist's rendering. We joked at the time that we were so poor that we couldn't even have a back button, right? Like our drawing just had this big disc up there where a back button might go. And you can see there are a lot of things that in this early stage were, hey, maybe we should, maybe we shouldn't. Maybe we should have a command well up in that upper left corner, right, and put more of the commands there. And it was interesting to figure out which things worked out and which things didn't work out as we applied the data and we looked at costs and then we did, again, I'll go back to those hundreds and hundreds of hours of usability studies. And so very briefly, you know, here was an initial thought of what I might look like. You can see this dates around the middle of 2007. And you'll see a few things, like the address bar has the top-level domain bolded in a very clear way. Right? So were you raising your hand or stretching? I still haven't been cut off. I'm not used to this at all. Okay, you were just stretching. I thought you might want to ask something. You know, like the top-level domain is bolded. And I'll give a very specific example of that. For all the phishing protections in the world, being able to go through and understand that you are at, say, citibank.com.evil.xu, right? When you look at that, you might just say, yeah, citibank.com, sounds great. But when the web browser goes and parses it, we understand the top-level domain is evil.xu. And so we go to evil.xu, and they happen to have some subdomains. And making it easier for a human to see that they're really at evil.xu, not citibank.com, period, is huge, absolutely huge. So, you know, from there, we realized to go to the data, 80% of the time people navigate, they go back to where they already were. So there is an art and skill around how you present what was, you know, the places people have already been and suggest them appropriately. There are other things to suggest from us as people type. We wanted to make it easy for folks to get back there. We want to make it easy for folks to use services together. This is where accelerators come in. I'll give you some examples. I think Georgia's got some great examples of accelerators to come. When you choose to map an address, it would be great to get something live and in person and meaningful and interactive, and I'll show you an example that's working. Now, remember, at this point, this is a prototype, not a lot of code written. And people are going, yeah, there will be this browser, and maybe there will be some XML. Yeah, I don't know about this. But the point is that we used the data to come up with the design and built a prototype. And then we built the product that made this prototype. Now I'm terribly confused. There are four screens, and I don't know which is going where. Where are you? Okay, well, go forward. Okay. Great. That sounds like a great place. And, you know, having this level of interaction. So, for example, up in the address bar, being able to type, I will eventually demo off of this. Are we going to switch back to? Okay, great. And then as I type here, please advance. as I typed here, being able to have a service interact and actually provide data back to the client in a rich, meaningful way. Now, again, the point here is that people use multiple sites and services together. How do we make it easy for services to plug into the browser, and how do we make it easy for users to get at those services? All right. And with that, I'm going to switch over and down. Before you switch over to my machine, let me try to restore a couple of these windows. And so, you know, over here, for example, you see that all these tabs that I opened up together were green, right? If I come over here and open up a new tab, let me turn that off for a moment. If I, you know, come over here and start, you know, I'll go up here to the Wall Street Journal. And like everyone else, I will, you know, wait on the web. When I start opening these up, you'll see that as these tabs open, as I said, I'm just waiting to see what else can go wrong right now. I'll actually hold down the correct key. You'll see that these tabs are grouped appropriately and colored. And that tab grouping and coloring, for example, went through a lot of iterations to understand people's logic. Well, if the color is too subtle, then they think there might be a bug. If the color is too brash, then they're really alienated. And, you know, finding the right notion, understanding that when tabs open up, you know, I talk about grouping as well as coloring. People had this surprise where they think, did I open up that tab? Because it opened up way here on the, I'm sorry, from where you guys are, way here on the end, not right here where I had it before. And so you really had dozens and dozens of different designs that were loosely coupled, iterating in parallel, that kept snapping at appropriate dates. Were there any other questions? Yes, go ahead. Users who opt in. So during setup, there's this whole thing, hey, you might have noticed, do you want to be part of the customer experience improvement program? Do you want to be a part of this program or that program? And for the most part, that whole notion of opting in is absolutely huge. There's a reporter, I'm gonna blank, but I'll make sure to get the data back to Methuen with a reference, who basically said that, I'm paraphrasing, I never thought I'd actually read a privacy policy, but I read IE8, and it's a great example of clarity. Right? It's this whole notion of data is an amazing exchange, and what we're doing is we're making sure that you get value in exchange for handing us explicit data. Right? And we're very respectful of that data. So every time there's a crash, right, there is a SQL counter that will, you know, go up. And we go through and try to understand, well, what are the biggest crashes and what does that mean? And so basically it's users who opt in. But again, the whole notion of opting in is that there's always an exchange. We want to make sure that, you know, you get something back for that. Yeah. Yeah, I think on XP you have this send error report, don't send error report. On later operating systems, we tried to incorporate that into other things since we found that people were confused around what might go in there. But yes, it definitely includes crash data. There are multiple pipes that come up to Microsoft that have to do with instrumentation on crashes, on hangs and reliability. There are also some two-way pipes. Think about all the anti-phishing and anti-malware systems that are in place. And there's definitely an art and skill in making sure that we respect your privacy as we protect you from malware and phishing. And that's a great question for Eric Lawrence, because he's really gone through all this notion of like, well, you can never really be anonymous. But what does it mean to be pseudo-anonymous or not person identifiable versus just safe? So there's a broad spectrum there. Any other? Uh-huh. So I think the basic question is, you're changing the colors on the tabs, on the address bar. Yes. 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 For what it's worth, the response is, even from completely neophyte users, been like, yep, live.com, that's where I'm supposed to be. Yeah, it's this fundamental, yeah, there's all this noise, but I know I'm at live.com. And so it's been, frankly, positive. In some ways, that's kind of the only part that really matters to people. And in some ways, it's been nice just to reduce background noise for them, because they're like, you know, let's have fun with this one. You know, it's mail.live.com default. You know, I'm sure everyone in this room knows what .aspx means, but, you know, the uninitiated, it's noise. Okay. So let me offer a couple of examples of you know, since I did that click through a few minutes ago and you saw that things were coming down, let me just offer a few things that show how we ended up building what we said we'd go off and build. So here's this search box, and I'll start here because I think this is a great example of what's good for the end user and what's an opportunity for developers. Now, as I type here, and just to prove this is a live internet connection, I will go through and, you know, type Britney, and this is essentially, you know, the test of TCP/IP at this point. Will Britney Spears come back, right? And you'll see that as I type, there's a live back and forth. Now, a lot of the time, what you'll see is just plain old search suggestions. And you'll see that if I just type something to get plain old search suggestions, that works against a variety of providers. There I'm getting live search, live lowercase l search suggestions from capital L live. And I can also get them from, you know, other search providers, like there are some Google suggestions and some Yahoo suggestions. And you'll see that there's some subtle coloring going on here, right? We wanted to make sure that people understood why they were getting what they were getting, and it's consistent here and into the and down into the address bar as well. Now, at the same time, we also thought this is this great opportunity because it's this whole web and there are pictures as well as text. What can developers do? And so, again, under all the appropriate open formats and licenses, putting the specifications out, you can see that different folks have done different things. I can go over to Amazon, for example. And Amazon has programmed this surface to offer a bunch of visual suggestions. And because it's Amazon, they're selling things, they chose their design. They can do whatever they want here. So Amazon goes through and says, buy new. This is how much it costs. And here's the rating. And up there, you know, Destiny is like, oh, here's how much money you'll save. So Amazon can do the things that Amazon thinks is best for Amazon in this search. And it's a great handshake. It's a great exchange. I, the user, said, I love Amazon. I want Amazon on here. Amazon provides me value back. It's a back and forth. It's very helpful in that way. Now I'll go through and I'll see what eBay has done. eBay has done something a little bit different. They'll offer some suggestions and some popular items. And, you know, frankly, that's a little bit different from what, say, Wikipedia has done. You know, Wikipedia shows the beginning, but again, you see that every developer, every site can go through and decide what is most meaningful to them. Let's take a big step back. And actually, you know, I should go and actually show the example that I had from that prototype. If I come back over here to Live Search and I type Seattle weather, you'll see that there's actually a suggestion. And what do you know? It's foggy in Seattle today. Who would have thunk, right, that it's ever foggy here? All right. So the point, stepping back, right, is that from an end user point of view, we know that people search a lot, right? Boy, they spend a lot of time searching. From a data point of view, we know that 70% of users have more than one search provider available to them. They've gone through and they've added at least one more, right? And so step one was, this thing down over here, Quick Pick, that makes it very easy to flip between that makes it very easy to flip between different search providers. Because we knew that 70%+ of folks had that. It's using the data and not just arguing, well, no one has more than one. Everyone just uses one. All right, so step one is users get value out of search. Okay? Make it easy for them to try out and use all their different providers. And step two is give developers an amazing opportunity. Developers can write whatever they want into the space. Well, is it unbridled HTML? Is it everything? Can you do, you know, XHR calls? Can you do mashups in here? No, because there's a security and a performance point of view. So there's a well-defined protocol, and it's documented. We have some samples up on MSDN and some samples on the IE blog, blogs.msdn.com/IE, that go through and put you in an amazing position. You can go through and offer what you think will be of most value to end users, right? And then they can try your thing out. And if it's useful, they'll keep using it. And if it's useful and they keep using it, you get more people coming back to your site. Now, let me take a step back, because if you're a developer, you go, okay, that's interesting. I can imagine doing some visual search stuff on my site. But if you're an IT pro, you might go, yeah, that's one of those like end-user consumer things. I don't really care. I want to suggest to you that there are some amazing IT pro opportunities there are some amazing IT pro opportunities for using these facilities in the browser to help your users get more out of IT. Classically, when people think about IT, they think, okay, there's manageability and there's deployment and, you know, how many policy-enabled registries do you have and how do I use the admin kit and tell me more about compatibility. Whole session on compatibility. Unbelievable work that we do on compatibility. For example, in the intranet, default into compatible mode. Everywhere else in the web, default into the most standards compliant interoperable mode we had. But I hear you, right? We listen to IT pros. I hope that we get it. I hope we get it more and more every day. Once you've done the manageability and deployment and compatibility analysis, there's this opportunity. We have a lot of internal sites here at Microsoft. And the ability to just be one click away in the search box from looking for a PO number, or to be one click away from looking for a ticket number, or being one click away from looking up a bug in someone else's database, right? That's a great opportunity. So you take your existing IT services and you wrap them with just a little bit of XML, right? Something that Giorgio can show you, something that you can read about, and all of a sudden get a lot of great value. Let me show another example of what I'll, yes, in the back, sir. Yes. Mm-hmm. More than 10. Okay. Sure. So, we can simulate this. I can make the search box very, very small, and then I can drop this down. Oh, sure. I'm sorry. The question was, hey, this kind of reminds me of that picture of Internet Explorer 11.5. Eventually, you're going to run out of pixels, and if you have all these quick perk providers, what happens? And the thing is, when you run out of pixels and you're truncated, we'll truncate, right? So here I am. I made the search box very, very narrow, and you see we picked up the first few. Now, one thing that I think is very important here, I'll go back to the question on privacy and opt-in, is that there's this underlying theme that might not be super important for developers and IT pros as such, but I think it's very important for us as people who use the browser. The user is in control. There's this ongoing theme about the user being in control, right? Toolbars that, you know, come from third parties get closed boxes. The user's in control. IE monitors the search setting to make sure that, you know, something external isn't changing your search setting out from underneath you. The user's in control. Over here, which search providers are in here? Under the user's control. You can go to iaddons.com. You can go to any site in the world, frankly, and it can offer search providers. And the user can go into manage add-ons and remove them or add them or change the default. In terms of which show up over here, the user can reorder them. Go into manage add-ons as a user, and you can say, I want Wikipedia to be my leftmost one, and I want the New York Times to be next, and I want to get rid of the Microsoft one. Okay. You know, it's your machine. It's your license of Windows. You installed it. Make it work how you want it to work. You are in control. I'm sorry, there's a hand up next to you as well.
He ranked clear to the top of the room here. So in the search provider and some of the other features like Accelerator and stuff, sort of
yep.
Story around being able to for the user to sign in as an authenticated user. So, for example, one of the questions that my ISVs have is how do they make sure that the person gets only the data that they're interested in, especially in search? And it seems like a great place to integrate would be in that search bar.
So the question is around authentication and how do you get the right per user things, whether it's accelerators or slices or search. And the basic story is that there, you know, we respect the whole cookie thing. And so, for example, when I think about web slices, it's easy now, right? We work through this. We have a lot of data feedback. that I can go through and have a web slice that has me authenticated in. So one of the web slices that I showed at Mix, for example, was a mail provider. So you can imagine being logged into multiple mail systems and having a web slice that lets you look at your webmail very easily. When you drop that slice down, let me drop a slice down, for example. I think none of the ones I have up here happen to be personalized. But when I drop a slice down, right, I can get some information. And by the way, for free, right, I can, you know, zoom in and zoom out of the traffic situation. And that could be a mail account where I've opted in. And there's just a checkbox for remember me. We actually have a couple of blog posts around making sure that, you know, how to think about that off. Because there are some subtleties there in terms of persistence. Am I using what? Marshaller? Virtual Earth? No, this is actually straight off of the Washington State Department of Transportation site. It's just their image. And, you know, the whole point here is that you can use whatever site you want in whatever way you want. In fact, this traffic slice is kind of interesting. This is one that I wrote in Notepad in about 10 minutes. Like, I just took Notepad. I took the sample off the iBlog. I wanted to make sure we were, you know, being respectful and being honest about things. So I took Notepad, and I just created a web page that included the image off the WSDOT server. And then I put it up on, you know, a domain that I happen to have. And then I said, yep, I can get to that web page. Now, exactly how long is it going to take me to figure out which tags to add to make it into a web slice? And it was about 3.5 minutes, mostly because I was using Notepad instead of a real development environment. And so to me, this is the reality check of how much work are we asking developers and IT pros to do? Now, this is the Seattle Bridges traffic. And you'll see that there are a bunch of folks doing some very interesting things. Here's, all right, now this is where I'm just going to apologize. I'm going to go to this one because I think that this one doesn't have any logos that have copyrights and issues. I think the other one actually has a specific sports thing, and I don't want to get anyone in trouble broadcasting things. So this is, you know, ESPN's, you know, here are the videos and here are their previews. One Riot did something, you know, unbelievably amazing here. I think they did a bunch of things with Silverlight as well. And it's swapping in. Again, I'm just waiting for the light bulb to burst or something here. So I'll go through, and you'll see that they have this very interactive slice, right? And there's, and you know, I can go through, and I can click here to watch the video. I can even do searches. It's always exciting to search on the web. You never know what results you'll get back. I can do searches, and they're going to bring the searches back inside of this slice. So now think about this one from a developer point of view. You've got a really cool website. You've invested all this time and energy in your website. And you know it's of value to people. But you wonder, how often am I going to be able to get them to come back to my site again and again and again? Or you can add a div and a couple of tags around different parts of different web pages. And then that site is always one click away in the user's favorites bar. So this is, you know, my daily driver machine. There's the Wall Street Journal. And now here's OneRiot. And I can go in here, and I can use this interactive part. And you can have multiple web slices on any given page. You can, there's no limit on how much you slice up and how much you offer to folks to get. And there's some amazing opportunities here. And, you know, let me start again with the IT pro side, because there are some IT pros who basically, I remember early on at Data One, they said, oh, yeah, it's one of those consumer things. We have a web slice that lets us see which term serve machines are available for folks to use. Because we have all these terminal servers, and people want to know, hey, I just need to go in and try an old XP image. Which one is available to me right now? Do I really want to navigate around to some favorite, and do I just want a website that says, here's the one that you want, and here's a link? We have a website that tells us how much money is left on our meal cart. Right? Like, do I need to grab my wallet, or can I just go down with my ID? You can imagine web slices that go through and say, here are the top support issues. Here, like, any piece of IT information that you have, you can offer as a web slice. And then people go through and can just have ready access to that one thing in their favorites part. They'll just drop it down. And it can be as rich or as poor, as interactive as you want to make it. But the good news is it's not extra coding. It's the page that you've already written with a couple of extra tags around it, just a div and this thing that says, hey, IE, make a web slice out of this. To me, that's pretty exciting. Now, another example, yes?
Steve, we have a question online relating to IT pros. Can the quick search plug into an intranet SharePoint effort?
Absolutely. Great question. So that whole search thing, it's just a URL, right? So we have the specification to get be very clear, it starts from open search, which is something that Amazon's A9 group worked on, and then we joined them in IE7 to create this open standard so that any browser can use any search engine. And then we extended open search a little bit more. And that open search specification means that you can go off and point to www.something very external or HTTP my local intranet server / whatever is it that you want. And again, from a user's point of view, they can just click on some text on a page and say, hey, I want to add this search provider. And then it's click and then a confirmation, because you don't want an unsolicited, visiting a page populates your search box for you. So from an end user point of view, that's super easy. And from an IT pro point of view, you can deploy these. You can make sure that every image that goes out to every desktop has, yep, here's our help desk search provider, and here's our this search provider, and here's our this search provider, and here are three web slices that would be of value to you. It's totally meant to work on the internet as well as it works on the internet.
Fantastic. Thank you.
In a web slice, is I a different session?
Yeah, so it's treated as a separate session. Especially when your web application or your internet using integrated security, like SharePoint and any of that stuff, when it pop up, does it require you to authenticate again every time you pop up a slide or pop up a...
No. The authentication should essentially just work per session appropriately. We do process isolation to contain the risk of crashes. Right, and there's a really nice demo mix. I was going to, repeat it here, where you see different things crashing separately and being contained. From an authentication point of view, it just works. It's rare that you need to go through and re-enter authentication credentials. Thanks. Yes. Oh, you're going to. Okay, great. Okay, cool. Any other questions before I? Okay, I'm just going to keep going then. So I've shown you a couple of slices. And, I'll show you an example of an accelerator. I got a piece of mail. This could be in Gmail. It could be in Outlook Web Access. It could be just in any old page. And there's a piece of text. Now, what we saw from the data, right, is that what people would do again and again and again, and user point of view, is copy, new tab, navigate, paste. Or the way it really works is copy, alt tab, swear, because now you're in Outlook. Alt tab back to IE, new tab, navigate, paste, swear, you grabbed the wrong text. Alt tab, swear, you're in Outlook. Alt tab back to IE, go back to the original tab you're on, select the thing that you really wanted this time with the right boundaries, copy, new tab, and you're doing this and you just want to scream. Because, we've evolved for so long, right, at least since 1995 on the web, right? And we've evolved for so long that you just don't want to do all this manual, repetitive, painful back and forth, right? Human copy-paste is not a happy thing. So here I am, and I got this note that was, right, I need to meet John at the Wamu Theater, Seattle. I have no idea where the Wamu Theater is. Now, you can go through, and, here I'm demonstrating that I actually use the Yahoo mapping service. Because, again, this is my choice. Right, I can choose whatever mapping service I want. I can use Live, I can use Google, I can use, whatever it is. And what I get here is this live preview. I can go through and I can zoom out and I can change the satellite view and I can move this around. Hey, look, there's 520. No, that's 90, isn't it? All right, that's 90. All right, so then you go through and you realize this is kind of like a mashup. This is that promise of mashups. Only, it's not like everyone's going to write a mashup every time they want to do something that's mashed up. What we end up doing is this copy-paste thing, right? We end up doing this copy-paste thing because it's easy. It's this path of least resistance. So I have a mail message. I want to get a map. I'm going to go copy, new tab, da-da-da-da-da, and do this. I can go through and say, hey, I'm in this mail message, and I want to tell a bunch of other folks that I'm meeting John at the Wamu Theater. I'll get that accelerator indicator. I could blog it. I could share it on Facebook. There's a Twitter accelerator. There are about 1,200 total accelerators, slices, search providers up on the IE add-on site right now. This is a great moment. I've been talking about the end user point of view. I'll talk about it from a developer and IT pro point of view. And I'll start with the technology. There's no script here. There's no debugging. There's no pain. right? It's just some XML markup. Basically, what you do is you say, I know that there's a web service somewhere, right? And that web service is literally just, I take this URL, http www. And I'm guessing this is, you know, maps.yahoo, something or other, and there's a parameter, and then there's a percentage where I put something in. You just take that URL, right? And you put it into an XML file, and you put a little bit of padding around it. You're just filling in a form. You're saying, I want this to be called the Yahoo Maps one. And yes, it does support a preview. And it should go into the category called maps. And then you have that little XML file. And you put it up in your server, and it looks like a link. And then the user comes up to the server and can click on that link and say, yes, I really do want this. Again, the user's in control. Visiting a page isn't going to just, you know, pollute their machine with lots of extra settings and things. So the user gets to click and then confirm. If you're an IT pro, you can deploy it onto their machine. And then wherever they go, whatever selection they make, you know, anywhere on the web, right, you can go through and get this little indicator that says, hey, there is an accelerator available. Now, why did we do that? Well, we actually started with just this right-click thing. We just thought, hey, people can right-click and get at these things. And we just thought, you know, we looked at the data on right-click, and boy, there are some people who really know how to right-click, and they right-click everywhere all the time. They're good students, right? They understand that right-click is the magic thing. Then there are a bunch of folks who are just going to work on Friday the same way they worked on Thursday. They're going to select some stuff. They're going to copy. They're going to new tab. And we want to give them some visual indicator, some beacon of hope that there's something else that they could do that might work out. And what's kind of nice is this indicator, right, is very ignorable. It doesn't jump out and scream. Like, it's not this paperclip dancing across the stage saying, it looks like you're trying to get an address. Can I help you here? Right. It's an eminently ignorable marker, but it's a visible marker. And you can go through and choose it. And go ahead and blog or Twitter or whatever it is that you're going to do. So from an end user point of view, it's in their flow. From a developer point of view, it really is easy to write. Look, if a general manager can write one in a couple of minutes, just imagine what you guys can do with real developer tools and time on your hands. Right? And then from the whole cycle point of view, you're pulling people back to use your site and your services in very meaningful ways. Now, with that, I want to show one other thing not related to these three opportunities, just really having a lot more to do with standard support, because I think that that's one of the, what I'll call, less reported facts of the Internet. I'll just show this quickly. So what you're going to see over here is a bunch of things that are completely out of order. There we go. So you have three browsers up here. And again, this is, it's great. It's 9:27. I'm going to spend 3 minutes on this, take a few more questions, and then thank everyone. So I'm just for context. This is probably more of a developer thing than an IT pro thing, but I think it's very interesting. There's a thing called web standards. And what's interesting is people just think web standards are out there, and they all just work, except in this one browser. And when we started working on IE8, there's a nod that says, yes, is that your point of view? That's your problem. Okay. All right, so this is a fun demo, right? Because we went through and we said, okay, let's look at all the standards that are, you know, making for pain on a daily basis and figure out what the right thing to do is. And we started with CSS 2.1. And it's kind of interesting. CSS 2.1, everyone goes, yeah, CSS 2.1, that's so 1998, it's been done, it's over. And there are a couple of facts about CSS 2.1. The committee is still meeting. They're not done. They're actually still editing the spec. So it's still not what I'll call a capital R recommendation, because nothing is ever called final. They're called a capital R recommendation. And we're on the committee, and we're working with them. And the spec's about yay thick. We started working through to say, all right, well, we want compatibility with the way IE used to work for all the pages that assume that IE works one way, and we want really good interoperability. And we started looking at this problem. We realized that there's all this variance in how different browsers take the same CSS. So we took what I'll call a modern software engineering approach to it. We have a test suite. And so over the last year, we've contributed over 7,200 test cases to W3C. And you come over here and you look up in the address bar, you'll see bolded up there W3.org, which is the Worldwide Web Consortium's website. And you see it's W3.org, style, CSS, test, CSS 2.1, current, da-da-da-da. So there are about 7,200 of these. Now, there are thousands and thousands of tests that pretty much all the browsers render quote-unquote correctly. And, you know, here's one of the thousands and thousands. This text should be green, this text should be green, this text should be green. I'm sure if you bring this up in IE7, it'll not be green. Okay, that's like one of n thousand. Now, at the same time, there are hundreds upon hundreds of tests that work a little bit differently. Let me show this one, for example. The following two lines should be the same, 123 and 123. And here it is in this other browser, 123, 123. This is the same URL, the same thing, right? This is available on the web. It was in the mixed demo, same URLs. You can see them up here. I'll come up over here, and you'll see that, here it is in another browser, and it goes 134, 123. Now, this is the same CSS. This is the counter increment aspect of CSS 2.1. And you know what? That's kind of a bummer, because this is a real-world interoperability problem just waiting to jump out and waste your time as a developer. Let me offer another example. There should be a green square below. I completely agree that there should be a green square below. And there really should be a green square below here. And I'll come over here, and you'll see that that's not quite a green square. And so you'll see that there's actually hundreds and hundreds of ways that these different browsers don't quite interoperate. And what we wanted to do was essentially move out of anecdote and myth and just get to a data-driven approach where there are these 7,200 test cases. And, you know, we're not done, right? There will be more test cases. At this moment in time, there are, you know, these 7,200 from last year, there are another 500 from over here, there are the 300 over here. And what we want to do is get to the point where the browsers really do interoperate. Now, these look like, oh, you just pulled that one out. Well, actually, out of the thousands, there are hundreds to choose from that work a lot like this. And if you think that this is artifice, this is what a test suite looks like. Here are the real-world examples from it. So here's a Contoso car rental site. And there you see that, you know, the steps are 1, 2, 3 in this browser. Now, over here, you'll see the steps are actually 1, 3, 4. Same content, kind of a bummer. Here in this browser, the steps really are 1, 2, 3. I'll come over here, and I'll say, look, there's this other sample site. Here's the same thing over here. You'll see this upper left part lays out a little bit differently. There's Contoso Traveler versus Contoso Traveler. Let me bring it up over here. You'll see that IE8 and this browser lay it out the same way. And I'll come down a little bit, and I'll come down a little bit here, and you'll see it looks the same over there. If you come over here to this browser, you'll see that there's actually an extra little splash of red that has to do with what was in that other test case. And so one thing that was very important to us was to deliver on what I'll call real-world interoperability. So instead of picking and choosing, we'll take a little bit of this one and a little bit of that one, and oh, there's a standard that they're still editing rapidly that no one's really gotten anything. And let's just go through and take one of them that's really important for daily reality, CSS 2.1, and do our best to be complete. And complete means we literally started on page one, we went all the way through to the end, and wrote test cases for everything that we found. And we published them out, and we took feedback. And we've got examples where we published out a test case, and people said, ooh, I disagree with that test case. We went, okay, why? And we had the conversation, and we changed the test case and published it back out. And, you know, again, I'm taking a step back because, I want to make sure that I leave time for questions, right, because I promised interactivity up front. And then just to recap the arc, I wanted to start from what's the context for a browser, right? There are the people who want a nightly build, and then there are people who really want it to change every couple of years. And what's the context for the browser in terms of security? What's the context of the browser in terms of end users? Then, you know, I try to talk about the data and how to do software at scale and how powerful that data can be. And what is it like to find a cow on, you know, some distressed concrete? Or what's it like to look at all this data and actually come up with something that doesn't look like a million toolbars? Then I completely didn't talk at all about security or reliability or general safety or the malware protections that are in the browser. I just tried to focus a bit in this overview on IT pro and developer opportunities, because I think from an IT pro point of view, there are a bunch of things that people go, oh, that's for consumers, but it's great for IT pros. And from a developer point of view, I think there are some powerful things like the developer tools. I didn't say anything about the developer tools. John Hervatten is, you know, just spectacular with the developer tools. I hope that you guys ask him about them in depth. I wanted to touch on this test case because I think that there are a bunch of folks who think when they hear IE, they think about the year 2001. And they're in a very 2001 mindset. I wanted to show the data and what 2009 looks like for IE. And the thing I haven't shown, which is a great thing to ask John Hervatten or any of the other speakers, is the balance between this new interoperability, this new real-world interoperability, and compatibility. And, you know, with that, I'm gonna leave this up and just stop and make sure I answer any additional questions all y'all have. Sir, in the back.
So does Microsoft Business Scorecard team just, like, hate you guys now, or what?
I'm
meaning, like, with these web slices, I see scorecard for my execs written all over it.
Have fun with it. I think that that would be a great thing. Frankly, I think that business scorecards are a great example of when it would be useful. I mean, it really forces folks to say, I care about this, and I want it back out. So I haven't gotten that feedback. I guess I haven't looked at my inbox this morning, but it could always come through. I think that, you know, there are some what I'll call real-world examples outside of scorecards that might be helpful. Like, I think about package tracking. You'll find an add-on on the add-on site for a site called Package Tracker. And it's kind of interesting. You can imagine that wherever you go, you just want to be able to select the package ID number and just get a map. Like, where is it? I ordered this video card. How far away from me is it? Right? Or, hey, I sent this present. I want to know how close I am to, you know, getting, you know, having fulfilled my obligation to this person. Like, will they get this thing soon? And so there are all these great examples of stitching together different sites and making them handy that I think, you know, I'm just waiting to see what developers do over the next year with it. Sir. Accelerators, yes.
Will it work for only the text or will it work for maps also? I mean, how exactly does it work?
It passes the selection through. So accelerators take a few different kinds of parameters. You can just pass the selection through. You can pass the page URL through as well. So there's some great accelerators like for DIG that basically that take the page's URL so you can say, yes, here's what folks on DIG are saying around this page, or here's how many times it was dug. So there are lots of attributes of the page you can pass through. I'm pretty sure there's a way to pass through other rich content on the page by reference. And there's an IE blog post on the topic, and I can't remember the particulars of it, but you'll find it up there. Sure. Are we using AJAX to? Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of AJAX involved. There's actually a lot of JSON involved also, and in addition to just why asking about AJAX, we built in some native JSON calls. Make it a lot easier for developers. You don't need to carry around a JSON library now. And boy, those JSON calls are really, really fast. There are also some interesting sanitization routines. Basically, this whole notion of I want some safe HTML. So here's some HTML on the page, and now I really want you to just strip out all the things that could be bad. And building in a safe HTML routine, I think, is great, especially when I think about how developers need to protect against script injection or SQL injection. Having those routines just built in native is super helpful. I'm sure regular expressions are involved in here. Again, there's this JSON back and forth as the user hits keystrokes to go up to the service, and the service can do just about anything, right, with those keystrokes.
Excuse me, deploying a splice, is that a cap file
based? Oh, no, there are instructions in the IAK. If you're trying to deploy an image with a splice, it's an easy thing just to point it to, and then the IE8 installation includes it. There are a bunch of examples of IAK'd, IE administration kit, IE installations that include, in addition to favorites, a bunch of slices and accelerators. In terms of deploying them out to machines, you have a bunch of choices. I mean, you can, you know, there's some nice policy, there's some nice ways to through files. There's also what I'll call the most manual one. I mean, the fact that it's two clicks for a user from a web page is quite nice. But there's a bunch of documentation on that. We really tried to make sure it was easy for for IT folks to get this stuff out to desktops where it matters. I've got time for one more question. And it could be from the web or in here. Go ahead, talk to the web. There's a cloud out there.
Actually, yeah, we have one question. What about a website that requires a secure logon?
Okay. So, yes. There are some very nice examples of web slices for email, for example. So I can go through and have my webmail inbox in a slice. And so there I am reading an article in the New York Times, and I can just take a quick peek at my, you know, webmail of choice and go through and say, yep, this is what's in there. Let me delete a few things. Let me respond. So it's the whole cookie-based authentication. We've got a great blog post about it. I know that there are a bunch of very interesting services between Dig, for example, or Facebook or webmail, and it does work, both intranet and internet. We have some samples. Okay. All right, so with that, I just want to say thank you for coming. Again, I know this started very, very early for real developers and IT pros. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dave.